Oh, are you ready? Okay, Ashley, thank you. We'll open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Open up an informational hearing from Dornbecker Children's Hospital, Dr. Stacy Nicholson, The First 1,000 Days. Thank you so much for coming today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. So, distinguished members of the committee, I'm really delighted to be here today to speak with you about the impact, particularly of nutrition, on the first 1,000 days of human life and its lifelong impacts on human health. But first, I think this is a real topic that not only impacts children's health and well-being, but again, is across the lifespan, and so it has impacts on our entire state, the entire population, as well as our state's economy. And I believe that Oregon has an opportunity to be a model for the nation and how we treat our children and how we prepare our population to be healthy and to be productive members of society. As a brief introduction, I am not a native Oregonian, but I've been very proud to call this my home for the last 16 years. I came here from the state of Maryland, where I had been for 12 years. I came here 16 years ago to start the brain tumor program at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. And all of my children have grown up here. They're all graduates, I'm proud to say, of Lincoln High School in Portland, Oregon. And my wife also is involved in children's health care. She's a physical therapist, and she works for the Clackamas County Educational Service District. So she's an employee of this fine state, helping the children with disabilities prepare for school. And as I said, I'm very proud to be an adopted Oregonian. For the past 8 years, I've been the chair of pediatrics at OHSU in the School of Medicine. And with that role, I am the physician-in-chief at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. And my primary responsibility as physician-in-chief is to ensure that there's high-quality medical care going on at Dornbecker. But I'm also in charge of ensuring that we have good quality educational programs so that the future pediatricians of this state are prepared, that we have a robust research portfolio so that we're curing more diseases tomorrow than we are today. And I'm also take my advocacy role as the head doctor at Dornbecker very, very seriously. And that's really why I'm here today, to advocate on children's behalf. And I really would like to see this state work together to make this the very best state to be a child in our nation. I think we can do that, but we have a ways to go. And today's topic is one topic that I think is very important, which is the nutrition for women and children and its impact on lifelong health. I'll also mention very briefly towards the end some data about literacy, because I think that's another area that we really need to focus on to ensure a great childhood for our kids. And my perspective is as a pediatrician and as a pediatric oncologist with a lifelong commitment to kids. This opportunity today stemmed from conversations that I've had over the last couple of years with Dick Withnail, who I think is well known to this committee. He's a great citizen of the state of Oregon and a tremendous advocate for kids. And he asked me, really challenged me, that what would I do as physician-in-chief at Dornbecker Children's Hospital right now, without taking a lot of time to plan, but what could we do right now to change the health of kids in Oregon? And really one thing I'm doing right now is speaking to you as leaders of the state who are responsible for policies that can impact the lives of kids. The public sector has a lot of roles currently that impact kids. A lot of the services of the DHS, our foster care system, our public schools, our parks and libraries, our health systems. Sadly, we also do turn to the correctional system sometime to help us with our kids. All of these have costs associated with them, and all of them, if we don't do them well, have increased costs down the road, I think we pay when we shortchange our kids. Kids often do get the short end of the stick in every single state just because they have no voice, they have no votes, and they have no money. One in three children in our country, and this is true for Oregon as well, live in a household where no adult has a full-time job. And so that's a statistic that predates the Great Recession. And is one reason why children are dependent upon state in health insurance, because health insurance is so tied to employment in our country. And we know that that the state health programs, Medicare, the Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan in our state, pays for less care than even Medicare does. We also know that there's a lot of determinants of health that are not just biologically related, but are related to socioeconomic status, and that kids often are in lower SES categories. But again, today we're talking mainly about nutrition. What have we learned in terms of the research about nutrition for women of childbearing age and particularly for pregnant mothers? We now know that the mother's preconception diet, and particularly the diet that she eats during pregnancy, will impact that future offspring's entire lifelong health. One area that happens during pregnancy is that what your mother eats during your pregnancy will inform your taste preferences for the rest of your life. And so if your mother eats great healthy vegetables, you'll actually be inclined to want to eat vegetables. If your mother is eating the high-fat, high-sugar American diet that so many Americans are eating, that will be your taste preferences when you come out on day one. That's already programmed in. It's also true that we're all dealt a certain genetic deck of cards, if you will, at conception, but then those genes are turned on or turned off by something we call imprinting or something we call programming, and one of the major impacts on that programming is the diet of the mother during pregnancy. And those genetic changes actually are not just for your lifetime, but in fact will go into your own sperm or your own eggs and be passed down for several generations. And so right now the current obesity epidemic we have in our country and the current high-fat, high-sugar diet that we have in our country, we're not only impacting the health of the next generation, but in fact, if everybody today went to a perfectly healthy diet, it would probably take 2 to 3 generations for the negative impacts of the previous diet for the last 50 years to work its way out of our society. This high-fat diet and high-calorie diet during pregnancy is one of the reasons that we're facing the epidemic of childhood obesity and the type 2 diabetes that's happening now even in childhood and also adult heart disease. We also know that stress hormones during pregnancy will also alter the expression of regulatory genes and that these things inform the vulnerability for disease later in life. And in fact, a lot of the damage is done prior to birth. There are, however, two organ systems that are not mature fully at the time of birth, and that is the central nervous system, the brain. If the brain grew as much as it needed to before birth, birth could never happen. The head has to be a certain size for birth to happen, and so that development a lot happens in the first 3 years of life. And also our immune system is, we're born with a fairly immature immune system. So diet during the first few years of life is also very, very important for those developing organs. Several fetal stressors that are known to impact a person negatively include undernutrition. So being born in a time of starvation or famine is not a good thing. But also the problem we face in our country is really one of overnutrition. I would also like to emphasize that really it's maternal diet, more so than maternal obesity, that's the problem. And one of the examples that we've had from our own primate center here in Oregon, so the Oregon National Primate Research Center, which is part of OHSU, has a colony of overfed monkeys. So there's a colony of monkeys out at the primate center that eats a high-fat, high-calorie diet, much as much of America eats. And those monkeys each year get fatter and fatter. And we have found that the babies that are born at the time of birth actually have very profound changes. And in fact, as an example, their livers are very similar to that of a chronic alcoholic. There's already so much damage to the liver from that high-fat diet that there's scarring in the liver at the time of birth. And we presume, and we're doing research now to figure out, is that happening to the same degree in humans as well. But one thing that we found from that colony of monkeys is that even though those monkeys are obese from that chronic diet, that if for a time before the pregnancy and during the pregnancy those mothers are eating a healthy diet, the damage that we see in the babies doesn't occur. So it's really diet during pregnancy more so than the mother being obese. High levels of stress hormones, I mentioned, in the mother is also something that can negatively impact children for lifelong, as well as low oxygen in the womb as well. Our current diabetes epidemic is really part and parcel due to this. We've also found, for example, undernutrition being a problem, a baby that's born at 5 pounds versus one that's born at a healthy weight of, say, 9 pounds, has an 8-fold higher lifetime risk of diabetes than the baby who's born with a normal, healthy birth weight.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
9 is defined as a healthy weight?
Yes. So eight or 9 pounds is a healthy birth weight. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a range there. You can certainly have a 6 or 7 pound baby that's totally healthy, but a 5 pound baby, one that's born at term but is only 5 pounds, that would be abnormal.
Madam Chair, we're going to have a break.
Yes.
Doctor, could you talk about alcohol and drugs on the mother? And we had a long debate on the floor today about medical marijuana. How does that affect? You know, we used to worry about babies being born of drug mothers, and hopefully that's better.
Well, certainly all medications, even prescription medications, can have an impact on the kids. Certainly drugs of abuse do have lifelong impacts on children. We've certainly seen epidemics of that in some of our cities, and alcohol during pregnancy as well leads to fetal alcohol syndrome. So many many obstetricians will take women off almost all medications that they're on during pregnancy because of either known or potential impacts on babies.
And Madam Chair, follow up. And so do we see a trend that there's not as many babies being born that are drug, you know, and we went through the meth. I mean, we had 4 or 5 years, 6 years ago, and everyone was, meth was the big thing, and we were having babies born with addicted to that. Is that, are we seeing a glow, is it going away from that?
My sense is that as people have known more about that, that's a little better than it was, but unfortunately, all those substances are so addictive that very often people can't get off of them even when they're pregnant. But my sense is that we are having less absolute numbers of those babies than we were for a time.
Thank you.
So a low-weight baby is more likely to be, did you say diabetic or obese?
Well, that's an example of babies born in famine, for example. Those babies are more likely to be diabetic. But also, it's also true for the babies of the overnourished, high-fat, high-calorie diets as well.
That just startles me. I've never heard that before.
On both ends, that increases your diabetic risk across your lifespan.
Can I get back to birth weight one
question? Yes.
So at what point does a birth weight tend to be too high? Because I think of 9 as really
big. 9 is pretty high. Really, once you get over 10.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Right.
And can I ask one more question
from
what you said to date? So I'm sorry to interrupt you. You had said that if even if a woman is very unhealthy, if she eats healthy during her pregnancy, then all of the negative effects are reversed, or most of them?
You know, in each individual case, it would be different, but I would say probably most. Uh-huh. But if there was a longer period of time before conception, mm-hmm. that the diet was healthy, it probably could be all.
Okay, great.
And in fact, this impact of diet during pregnancy will outweigh most other environmental exposures that children and young adults will get in terms of most diseases. Certainly, there are other things like smoking, for example, that would certainly overweight that. But the main things that we all come in contact with pale in comparison to what happens in the womb.
Wow.
And again, right now we have nationwide this type 2 diabetes and obesity epidemic. And we would refer to what's going on in our country really as high-calorie malnutrition, not eating a good nourishing diet, but we have plenty of calories in our country. We also have reductions in physical activity. People are, particularly children, sometimes have less availability of physical activities in the schools. The kids spend a lot more time in front of screens these days where they used to be outside playing. All of those impact the lifelong risk of diabetes. And so really, this mixture of a calorie-rich, nutrient-poor Western diet, a lot of inactivity, and also the modification of our genes by these conditions in the womb are leading to a time when we expect now 1 in 3 Americans will suffer from diabetes in their lifetime. And that's really something that we need to do something about, and if we can, it will not only impact the health of individuals, but the health of our society, our healthcare economics, and also really all of the economic activity within our state and within our country. I think I've painted a fairly bleak picture of where we are today, but I think there's a lot of reasons for hope. I don't know that we have all the answers currently, but if we can impact the diet of women of childbearing age, adolescent women, adolescent girls, and women of childbearing age, and if we can take away the programming part, the damage to the genes that stem prior to birth, that will eliminate two-thirds of the risk of lifetime diabetes by itself. And so that's really the focus of my remarks today, is to raise that issue. And again, I don't necessarily have all of the answers to how we can do that. It is one of the most important issues facing us today. The current trajectory of increasing diabetes and increasing obesity in our country is really frightening. And I think that we don't realize yet as a society how important the health of our next generation is and how that's tied to the nutritional status of women and girls in a way that we haven't really thought of before. And I think that, there are other areas that we've had really clear societal change. Smoking, for example. When I was a child in the 60s, my father smoked. Almost every adult male I knew smoked. That has changed. And at some point in time, the non-smokers started owning the air, and there was a real societal change. And certainly, if any of us see a pregnant woman smoking, we tend to have a visceral reaction to that. We understand as society and as individuals in our society that that is causing harm to that fetus, who will then become a child, who will then have lifelong problems due to that. We don't necessarily have the same response today viscerally when we see a pregnant person consuming a high-calorie, high-fat diet. We say she's eating for two.
Representative
Gallegos? Yeah, I'm wondering if you could maybe share some insight into some discussion we've been having at the legislature. For example, the genetically enhanced wheat, for example, and so on. And when we think about nutrition, I don't know. I mean, some of my thoughts are that, you know, we've been eating genetically enhanced food for a long time. Is that a problem in terms of the nutrition that you're speaking of, particularly with women, childbearing women, and so on?
Yeah, I don't think that in terms of what we're talking about today that would be a specific problem. The kind of programming that goes on in the womb to the fetus is based on the calorie intake, the type of calories, and the mix of fat, carbohydrates, and proteins. And I don't know that, for instance, genetically modified wheat or other crops would have an impact one way or the other on that.
Can I follow up another? Along the same lines, I mean, I'm thinking also about income levels and, for example, the difference between organic produce, organically grown foods, as opposed to, for example, in my district, we've got a number of different food outlets, and depending on what neighborhood you go to, you're going to find very different levels of produce, the freshness, and so on. I guess what I'm trying to get at is really the differences in terms of income levels, and how do we then address low-income diets, for example, for these women?
Right. That's a really great question. And certainly socioeconomic status is very tied to nutrition, because a lot of fast food in particular is very high calorie and it's very inexpensive. And so if you're feeding your family on a budget, from an economic standpoint, that actually makes some sense. I think that I think most of us feel that organic food is probably better than non-organic food. But in terms of just basic nutrition, I'm not sure that there's enough of a difference between those two for someone who can't afford the organic foods to feel bad about providing fresh fruits and vegetables that aren't labeled organic. I think in terms of good nutrition, certainly fresh fruits and vegetables are one of the keys there, and I think if you don't have access to that, frozen vegetables are also quite good, because those are typically frozen on the same day they're picked. And so they in fact have a lot of the pretty much same nutritional value as fresh fruits and vegetables do. Mm-hmm. we certainly do need a lot more research, and I think a lot of where we need our research now is what are the effective strategies around which we can have societal change, because I think we know enough already to know that we need to change the diet of our society. And while we'll continue to work on that research, I think a lot of what we need to do is how do we change the behavior of our society. One area is, and Oregon is actually a leader in terms of breastfeeding. We have some of the best statistics in the country, but still we don't have all of our children exclusively breastfeeding for the first 6 months. That actually would be one of the things that we could do, particularly for that postnatal period. So I also want to just bring to your attention some of the things that we're doing at OHSU and at Dornbecker to try to help with this first 1,000 days and nutrition in the womb and nutrition also in the first few years of life. We were very, very grateful about 2.5 years ago to get a $25 million gift from Bob and Charlie Moore. You probably are aware of Bob's Red Mill, an Oregon-based company that really promotes whole grain eating as a healthy diet. And Bob has really charged us with, while he's interested in us doing research, he's like, I know what we need to do. How do we just get people to do it? How do we get people to eat a whole grain diet and eat fruits and vegetables? And in fact, he's charged us really with trying to transform the behaviors of the citizens of this state so that we have a healthier state. And in fact, the purpose of, as you'll find on our website, for the Bob and Charlie Moore Institute on Nutrition and Wellness, is the central commitment is to reduce the prevalence of chronic diseases across the lifespan in current and future generations by promoting healthy, nutrient-rich diets based on whole foods in early life, before conception, during pregnancy and lactation, and in infancy and early childhood. And again, we're focusing a lot of the research that we're doing around the state on how do we go into a community and can we, in fact, educate that community and change behaviors. So we are trying to educate people. We do know from lots of other public health problems in the past that education by itself doesn't really change things. People know, by and large, that high-fat, high-calorie diets are bad for them. Knowing that hasn't been enough to change people's behavior. If we can do this, though, we'll reduce the burden of chronic disease in our population. We'll reduce the healthcare expenditures by both private employers and insurers, as well as the state, and make Oregon the healthiest state in the country. And as I've heard our governor talk about when he talks about the healthcare transformation, boy, wouldn't you want to relocate your company to a state that has the healthiest population, where you knew you're going to spend less money on health care than in other states. We're also doing, as I mentioned, research. I gave you an example of our Oregon Primate Center. One of the women on my faculty has a great project right now, actually in our neonatal population. Pregnant women are very, very motivated to change. They're probably the most motivated group of humans that are out there, and the best example of that is smoking cessation. Nicotine is very addictive. It's very hard to quit smoking once you've started. But the highest rate of smoking cessation in our country are pregnant women. There's an 85% success rate. No other group comes close to that. It's usually 50% at best. And so pregnant women are very, very motivated to change. In terms of those 15% who can't stop smoking, we know from those studies of those women that those children, those babies will be born with poor lung function compared to other babies, and that poor lung function is not just at birth, but in fact at a year of age and at 5 years of age, those children are more likely to have wheezing and asthma and other respiratory diseases compared to other children. I have a faculty member who is showing that vitamin C infusions during pregnancy for those women who can't stop smoking is reducing that problem for those newborns. So we're actively trying to intervene for those mothers who can't make that choice to stop smoking. And so that's an example of some of the work that we're doing. We're trying right now to improve the care of pregnant women and neonates across this state. And about 2.5 years ago, in partnership with other hospitals around the state, Sacred Heart and Eugene, our partners in Medford, our partners in Bend, and now also here in Salem, We started what's called the Oregon Perinatal and Neonatal Network, and we were working together across the state for the providers of high-risk pregnancy care to women as well as neonatal care to sick newborns. We're doing teleconferences every 2 weeks. We're talking with each other about how best to take care of these babies, and we're trying to ensure that babies get the right care at the right place at the right time as close to home as possible. We're also bringing to that mission telemedicine. Our pediatric intensive care doctors are now in 11 hospitals around the state using telemedicine, and our neonatologists are now in about 3 hospitals and soon to be 5, providing neonatal resuscitations when there's an unexpected problem at birth. And our doctor can be on the telemedicine equipment within a minute and guide that resuscitation around the state, and that's improving outcomes. This program has a huge impact on our rural communities in particular, and I grew up in a rural part of North Georgia, and I understand the challenges that rural health care has, and this state has a large area that's rural and also frontier, and by using this technology, we're trying to improve the health of children. Another way that we're currently doing that is we're committed, as are many hospitals now around the state, to not do an elective delivery prior to 39 weeks gestation. The longer we can keep a baby in the womb, the better. And so I'm really proud that the state has made that commitment. We started at Dornbecker 2 years ago a fetal therapy program, and I'm really thrilled about that. That's one of the most exciting things I've seen in my 16 years here. And how that program works, if you're a family and your local obstetrician has discovered that there is a problem with the baby, then you come up and spend the day at Dornbecker. You get all the various tests, the ultrasounds and other tests that you need to find out exactly what's going on. And in a room much like this, you end the day sitting there with whichever Dornbecker doctor is going to need to be present to take care of your baby once it's born. And we also, in that conference, bring in, using this teleconferencing equipment, the home obstetrician, so that that doctor can be part of this conference to find out, to make a plan as to what happens. And so those families leave Dornbecker at the end of the day knowing what the plan will be. And for example, if it's a congenital heart defect, and if it's a serious heart problem where that baby might need surgery in the first hours of life, we will try to ensure that that mother moves to Portland within a couple of weeks of her due date so that she can deliver at OHSU and that baby can in fact have surgery without being transported across the state as a very sick newborn. If on the other hand it's a fairly minor heart lesion and we determine that that baby just needs to see a cardiologist within the first month of life, well then go ahead and be born in Coos Bay or in Bend or in Klamath Falls with your family, with your social network, and then come up to Dornbecker and see our doctors within that first month of life. And I'm really, really proud of the work that's being done there by our staff and by also our partners in obstetrics. I also mentioned that we're trying to educate people who take care of newborns, and our neonatal faculty have developed curriculum that's now being widely used around the world on neonatal resuscitation. We've done that in partnership with the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'm very, very proud of that as well. We've also learned in our research laboratories that some of the brain damage that can be done at birth if there's low oxygen, we used to think that was irreversible, but now we know that it's not. We know that those brains can heal, and we're trying to look for ways that we can help those brains heal better. And so hopefully we can reduce the burden of cerebral palsy in the future. While most of my remarks today have been around nutrition, around those first months of life, even prenatally, I'd also like to bring to the attention of this committee one thing that we're doing at Dornbecker that really also pediatricians across the state are doing, and that's our Reach Out and Read program. And basically, we're providing books. When kids come in for their well-child visit, they can leave with a book. And to use language that we pediatricians understand, we view this program as an immunization against illiteracy and also an immunization against poverty, because literacy is so important to prevent poverty. Just a few statistics around that. We know that literacy is learned and that illiteracy is often passed along by parents who themselves cannot read or write. In our country, 1 in 4 children grows up knowing not how to read. We still have about a 25% illiteracy rate if you look at it at a certain level. We also know that if you can't read at the end of third grade, that is the best predictor of dropping out of childhood, of high school. And in fact, I heard a speech, I think you may have been at the luncheon a couple of years ago for the Children's Institute, and he was a vice president of the Children's Defense Fund, but made a great statement that children don't drop out of high school. They leave school in high school because they can't. They drop out in fourth grade because they can't read. That if you aren't reading by the end of third grade, that's the best, unfortunately, the best predictor of not being successful. We know that 43% of adults who are illiterate live in poverty, compared to only 4% of those who read at the highest levels. We know that 3 out of 4 food stamp recipients are in the bottom 2 literacy levels. 90% of welfare recipients are high school dropouts. And we know that older adolescents, 16 to 19-year-old girls who are at the poverty level and below, they're more likely to have out-of-wedlock children than those children who have higher reading skills. And we know that low literacy costs at least $73 million a year in our country in healthcare costs. And so I'm putting out there that one other thing we can do for kids is to ensure that our educational system is teaching them to read. I'll also mention one thing that we're doing, which is we established the Tom Sargent Safety Center because we know that while much of Dornbecker is fighting cancer and fighting heart disease and cystic fibrosis and the other disease of children, the number one killer of kids under the age of 14 is accidental death. And so in our safety center, we provide helmets, bike helmets, ski helmets, skateboarding helmets at cost to these families so that we don't want cost to be a reason why kids out there on a bicycle without a helmet. We're also providing training and materials for child-proofing the home and also training in how to safely install and correctly install a child safety seat. About 75% of child safety seats in cars are installed improperly in this country. And then we're very excited about working with the CCOs, not only our local CCO in the metro area, which we're part of HealthShare, but really CCOs reaching out to them across the state to try to identify what we call the hotspotters, the kids, the 5% of kids that are consuming 25% of the healthcare dollar, to try to help those kids through care coordination be healthier and stay out of the hospital. Because the main thing that will happen with that is those kids will be healthier, but it will also drive down healthcare costs and help us beat these rising healthcare costs that are in danger of bankrupting our state and bankrupting our nation.
How can you find those hotspotters?
Well, it's there's a fair amount of data. We're finally getting to the point where medicine is always late to adopt business practices compared to most other businesses. So the electronic medical record is finally paying off, I think, in that we can now get data about our patients that was hard to get before. And so we simply can now go through the billing codes and we can find the answer for last year, which were the 5% of patients last year who drove 25% of the cost. Many of those patients are still in that group. And the trickier question that we're trying to work on is how can we predict next year's high utilizers? And so, for instance, many of us think that graduates of our newborn nurseries, the intensive care units, the ones that are sick babies when they first come out, are likely to be those kids. We know that any kid with cystic fibrosis, any kid with cancer, those will be on that list as well. And providing, a lot of the time it's going to be simply providing those families with better care coordination, better ways of getting their questions answered, and ensuring that those patients are taking their meds and doing what they need to do. And we're working with those CCOs and with insurance companies to try to provide those services. And we're just in the infancy of getting that started now, but we're very excited about that possibility.
Well, we're stumped. We had a woman coming in a few weeks ago, Donna Beagle, who herself had been homeless for many years, and talking with us about poverty and generational poverty. And I think one of your questions is about how is it that poor people, I mean, I'm still stuck on pregnant women, and how can we provide the kind of nutrition and the help that they need that's so important. You're obviously saying this is going to be affecting the child's lifetime and perhaps their offspring's lifetime.
Right, that's correct.
So that is so important. So I'm sort of stuck there. When kids are in school or even when they're in preschool, we can do something about nutrition. I'm concerned about targeting some of these pregnant women or young women before they're pregnant, hopefully young women, before they're pregnant, and what it is we can do so that they don't become hot spotters, so they're not the ones that are going to be using so many, not of our just our healthcare dollars, but our social service dollars.
Right.
So Do you have any sense of that? Does Doernbecher?
Well, I think right now it's really a great question. It's the core question, I think, of where we are right now, mm-hmm. is for prevention, you want to reach mm-hmm. back as far as possible.
Exactly.
And a lot of what I'm talking about today is nutrition during the formative months of our lives is really important. But really, I think adolescent females, the girls that are in middle school and high school, if we can somehow reach those girls with this message so that it's there deep down, mm-hmm. Embedded in their brains, so that when the time comes when either they get pregnant unintentionally or whether they, when they're ready to plan for pregnancy, hopefully there'll be the knowledge there that they will then, if they're not already eating healthy, do so at that time. I think that the adolescent female population, to my thought, is where we'll get the biggest bang for the buck over the long haul. Women before they get mm-hmm. pregnant the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank
you. Yes. We used to talk about teenage pregnancy as being a double sort of developmental problem. I mean, these young women are not fully developed themselves, having babies who then are underdeveloped as well. Now, I wanted to ask or make a comment about Head Start as well. I mean, we've got Healthy Start. We've got literacy programs within Head Start as well. I mean, it seems like a very similar kind of concern in that federal program, and I just wondered how there might be coordination between your efforts and some of those nonprofit efforts as well.
Yeah, I think if we can join the issues that the healthcare system can bring to the table, the school system, community supports, nonprofits, I think the better we can coordinate those efforts in our communities, the more likely we are to be successful.
Okay. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nicholson, and you're speaking to my huge passion. It's my primary focus here, and love to work with you more on these issues. We have a number of bills that many of us have signed on to, like the WIC Farm Direct mm-hmm. program, which is, you know, directly pregnant women and children under five.
Right.
Also helps the local economy.
Right.
And there was a request for $500,000 in that, and it sounds like there may be $100,000 in the budget. Would love to see that go much higher. So we have a number of different efforts in the nutrition area, also for summer breakfasts, after-school programs for school-age kids. You know, midwifery, we have a midwifery bill. There's just a whole variety of different ways that we're trying to increase prenatal care, make sure that prenatal care gets to women in their first trimester, which Oregon has been really in the low end statewide, nationwide on getting to people in those first 12 weeks. So a lot of different initiatives there. One of the things that I've been trying to, since I'm on the health committee too, push in our CCO transformation is that our outcomes should not only be based on how many visits to the doctor, but actually real outcomes like birth weight and other kind of indicators of healthy right. pregnancy, healthy birth weight. So that's some of the other things. Certainly you touched on stress in low-income populations, and there's so much evidence also about the cortisol and what that actually does to the development of kidneys in the 34th week or whatever. You know, you can really trace a lot of those things. So that's, you know, you want to do the one-on-one education, but we've got to look at things that are get at that public health, social determinants of health. The other one I was going to mention as a real highlight that's of huge concern for me is endocrine disruptors, because it shows that the connection between that, BPA, and other kind of endocrine receptor toxic chemicals, and type 2 diabetes is very closely connected. And then there was articles that just came out in the paper about the heavy metals in air pollution and how that looks like there's a correlation at least with autism.
Right.
So, again, you know, those are public health measures, not a one-on-one education with women, which, of course, we need to keep trying. But how do you get at some of the environmental factors? So, very delighted. I've seen at one point we tried to get Kent Thorburn and Larry Wallach here to show the origins of health first 1,000 days slideshow that they have that shows that intergenerational since World War II when the advent of the fast
right.
food. And I still hope that we can do that in and love for you to join them in September or mm-hmm. November. But
I'd be happy to. They're very great, passionate spokespeople for this area.
Yeah. And the other thing I was just going to say is you know, just the extent to which we change our thinking, I'm going to go into a really touchy area here, I'm aware, on subsidy programs and whether we continue to just focus on calorie versus nutrition. So, of course, the SNAP has come up a lot recently, and it's federal, and how much can we do locally. But just really looking at, you know, I had the very popular vending machine bill because we're subsidizing vending machines in public buildings, and that became kind of a laughingstock. But I was like, we have got to get at this in every single way that we can, because it's not just education and it's not just personal behavior, but how do you change the environment? How do you provide healthy fruits and vegetables where we have food deserts? I mean, every single way that we can get at it, it's so huge. So really appreciate you coming.
Well, thank you so much. I think you're absolutely right. We need to make healthy eating the easy choice.
Right.
And right now it's actually very difficult for many people to eat in a healthy manner, I think.
One of the issues that we had heard in this committee was asking the question of women early on, are you planning on getting pregnant in the next year? And I hope that that goes out to all the physicians that see young women, that if you do plan on getting pregnant, then this is what you need to do to prepare. If you're not, then are you looking at some type of birth control so that there can be some options there that women are aware of?
Yeah, and also be it.
Yes.
I'm also interested in the whole issue of racial disparities with regard to healthcare. Obviously, diabetes being a great example of the issues. Native Americans, Latinos being three times as likely as the general population to have diabetes. I mean, I guess from what you're saying, I can blame this on my mother, but, you know, all those tortillas and frijoles and stuff. But seriously, I think if there's a way we can begin to parse out and recognize sort of the cultural differences and the different eating habits and cultural sort of stuff.
I think that's an excellent point. And certainly there are different populations who have different risks at baseline and who are more susceptible to the high-calorie, high-fat diets than others.
Any other questions? I think we interrupted you. Did you finish your presentation?
I was just about to wrap up. Just to get back to Dick Withnail's question, you know, what would I do? And I mean, how can we make Oregon the best state in which to be a child? And I think, you know, we'll certainly do our part to try to make sure that we have a great children's hospital in case the kids get sick. But in terms of societal change and driving prevention, I do think that with kids being the poorest members of society, we do need a robust safety net. And I think access to, you know, to good nutrition as well as simply calories is really important there. I'm very excited to live in a state that provides universal coverage for kids for health care. I think that's an important step forward. I was very proud when Governor Kulongoski came to Dornbecker in 2009, I believe it was, and signed that bill into law. I think that's great and is a very important part for making Oregon a great state for kids. One thing that happens in Great Britain that doesn't happen in this country is there's universal nurse visits during the first 2 weeks of life. And I think as parents, particularly for that first child, you know, we all have to take a test and get a driver's license before we first get in the car. That doesn't happen for parenthood. And so if we had some way of better training parents for that first challenge, I think that would be helpful to kids. As I mentioned, a very robust educational system is very important. But I do also think that, again, going back to one thing I said, one out of three kids living in a family where no adult has a full-time job, we do need also to have a very robust economy with family wage jobs. I think that's one of the things we can also do for kids. And we at Dornbecker would be very glad to partner with you in trying to make this the very best state in the union for kids.
Thank you so much. Any further questions?
Can I ask you a brief question?
Of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late, and you may have already covered this. But in addition to having universal health care coverage, we do universal screening for hearing for newborns when they're born. Our education committee spent some time with the School for the Deaf this year, and one of the things that we learned is the majority of kids that they see have no method of communication with their parents and often had no meaningful language introduction until they were 5 or 6 years old. What are we doing for parents to help help with language development in these newborns that are identified as deaf or hard of hearing so that they don't have to wait until they're 4 or 5 or 6 years old to begin having any kind of communication?
Yeah, that's a great question, and off the top of my head, I'm not 100% sure, you know, what we're doing in the healthcare system for those children, or what we're doing in the early intervention programs in our educational system. So I'll try to research that and get back to you on that.
Thank you.
I'm assuming that when you talk about the first 1,000 days, you're talking about the 270 days. Of pregnancy.
Yes, that's from conception. So that goes through almost about 2.5 years after birth.
Yeah.
That's really the critical time period.
Right. And I'm glad you stressed that because I think that's something we're all aware of, but we need to hear it over and over and over again.
But
and
what it is. It does include the time in the womb as well.
Right. And so what do we need to do that? And go back to Dick with Nell's question. When you do have an answer, I hope you come back and tell us what that mm-hmm. is.
Okay. I'll work hard for that.
Any last questions? Thank you again so much for coming today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for your attention.
You're welcome. Thank you, committee. Oh, with that, I'll close the informational hearing and close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.